OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Hello there, you're welcome along to Golf Weekly. If you have downloaded the podcast on Thursday, if you're watching on our social channels, or indeed if you're listening to the radio on a Sunday afternoon, you are most welcome. The guest today is a Waterford man who is forging his career on the PGA Tour. Seamus Power is going to join us very shortly. In the meantime, Nathan Murphy is here. Hello.
How are you?
Very well. Fionn Davenport in Manchester. Hello.
Hey, Joe.
No Peter Laurie today. He is prepping for the reopening of Spawell Driving Range Monday morning, 10 a.m. Get along, support the business in the next while. I'm sure lots of you are desperate at golf balls and many a back garden has been decimated. So golf is one of those things, Nathan, which is getting back up and running over the next week or so.
I expect that the grass at Spawell will be Augusta-like, considering how much time Peter has spent away from his family over the past couple of months, just fine-tuning things. But yeah, a small sense of normality returning. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out over the next couple of weeks. When golf does return, how different people find that experience. I'm really regretting giving up my membership.
Would you have been within the 5K?
Well, if you guess the, you know, you go across the mountain, kind of possibly.
The bird flies.
Are you within 5K?
No, I'm nowhere close. I'm going to be absolute Paddy Last into that golf club. 20th of July is when I'll be allowed in. Now, anecdotally, I have talked to people who I would say are in a similar vicinity to me. And I pointed out, Jesus, it's a pity for us. We're not going to be able to play until 20th of July. And their response has been a little bit, you know, come on, 5K, 15K, 20K. Does it really matter? The golf club is open. So I suspect the lure of a golf club will be too much for people to resist.
I will be interested to see what the reaction of the guards is. Like, is it going to be so extreme that they're literally camped outside some golf courses, stopping people on the way in? Maybe it is. I know, I don't know about you, but going in and out to the office every Thursday, I've been stopped pretty much every single week asking where I was going. And if people are going to be abusing it, you would imagine it'll get known very quickly. Like, do people call each other out? You go, well, I know you don't live here. You know, I'm out playing with my dad who's 78 and you've come from 25 kilometers away. How does that work? Like, that is part of socially as we all adjust to a sort of new normal. How react to other people who do break the rules when you're sticking with the rules?
But you're Joe Malloy, and you know, you're just no ordinary. You're a well-respected broadcaster, Joe Malloy. You know, Caesar's wife must be seen to be above reproach.
Well, I've just admitted that I'm outside the 5K zone now, so if I turn up...
What you should have done, Joe, is gone, I was really glad that I moved to the vicinity of Killeen.
Yeah.
This new house. What are the chances? I did like that idea that they had been thrown around, but obviously isn't coming to pass, of if you were a GUI member, so if you had a handicap, for these first few weeks, you could play at the club closest to you, which was, I think, quickly, I'd imagine, by some of the more expensive courses.
Shut down.
But I presume there's actually going to be a lot of golf courses, particularly in rural areas. Like, I think back where I'm from in Ballyhonus, that the club itself is almost, I would say, 5K, if not slightly over, from the town.
Yeah.
And even then, how many people live in the town? I would say maybe a quarter of their membership. Luckily, listener Emmett Kane lives right beside the golf course, so he'll be just fine.
Well, of course he does.
Emmett Kane.
I would presume the vast majority of golf club members right across the country, not least in Dublin, are all outside of the 5K.
Hmm.
So we'll have to see how well it's observed.
Luckily enough, in the UK, we don't have any such problems. Golf courses reopened yesterday to members. No limit or restrictions on how far you can travel to play. The only restrictions we have is that you can only play in two balls and you have to maintain social distancing at all times. the clubhouses themselves will be closed, the bars will be closed. You can literally rock up, play, and then go home again. So I'm on the timesheet for tomorrow. And that's although it was curious, I watched the thing this morning. So tennis and golf are the two sports that opened up yesterday. But here, this is a curious one for anyone who does play tennis. You can't pick up the ball with your hand. You have to use your racket, you know, to kind of, you know, double tap on it to lift it up. And there's no serving because that would involve you holding a ball in your hand. So you can lob the ball up with your racket and then just kind of underhand it over the court.
That's interesting. I was wondering about that. My dad plays tennis. I was making that very point to him. I was suggesting you'll have to use your own balls for your own service games. But I guess that works fine too, not serving. Like, it's really just to get back playing in any kind of way.
So tennis have taken a different approach, though, because tennis aren't allowing the over 70s back.
Okay.
Whereas it seems, are, or certainly there's been no mention of whether or not, as long as they're inside the 5K radius.
Okay. Well, so that's happening this week. There is live golf this weekend on your TV. It's a charity match. Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson versus Ricky Fowler and Matthew Wolf. This is a $3 million skins game. TaylorMade, heavily involved. It will be on PGA Tour, NBC Sports and Sky Sports, so you can watch that, to be followed next week by Tiger versus Phil with Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. I'm saying now I'm not overly interested in this match, but I'll probably give it a cursory glance over the weekend. The interesting news, because I know, Nathan, a couple of weeks ago you were wondering what shape the PGA Tour return might take, and we'll talk to Seamus Power very shortly, but Rory McIlroy has given the whole thing a bit of an impetus. He has said, and the plan is to return on June the 11th in Texas, he's going to play the first three events. So he's going to play the Charles Schwab Challenge in Texas. The following week, they go to Hilton Head in South Carolina. And then the following week, we have the Travelers Championship in Connecticut. McIlroy said, I missed the competition, missed the buzz of getting into contention. And I also missed the locker room. I missed the people. So suddenly, those three events, which may not have had McIlroy in normal times, are off to a seriously good start. That suggests this thing will be very watchable and significant, as opposed to 50 players, a lot of them lower down, no top players playing. So that's a really good development for the tour.
For the tour, it's huge, yeah. I definitely expected that a lot of players would sit out the first few weeks and just see the lay of the land and how safe it all ends up being. But the fact that McIlroy, maybe there was a sign there when he signed up to play for this charity tournament that he just wanted to get back out there. And likewise, you see Shane Lowry on his Instagram is out on the course every day practicing, that life somehow is returning to some sort of normality in Florida and around America, and they're going to go and play. And clearly they've been given enough assurances. They obviously have very good personal doctors, I'm sure, who are giving them advice as well. And they feel that they can implement social distancing. Rory's talking about being in the locker room. I wouldn't be spending too much time in the locker room.
Yeah, it's true. Well, it was a good piece in Golf Channel where they outlined how it's going to look. The players have been sent like a 37-page document with all the protocols. So they'll be, you know, tested when they land on the flight, testing before and during the weeks. All the players will be asked to use one or two hotels for the week. So if you want to stay in a rented house, you need special dispensation. They want to put them all together in a hotel, in effect have a tournament bubble. And then if you play in Texas and you're going on to play at Hilton Head, you don't travel privately. So a transfer plane has been organized, which will take the players to the next tournament that they're, if they are playing on. No family, no agents, no early week interviews, no Wednesday pro-am. Swing coaches are allowed there, but they'll be at a designated station that you go over and stand in. They just sanitize their hands after every hole, all of this sort of stuff. So it's fairly detailed and comprehensive. And if you test positive at any stage, you withdraw from the tournament immediately and you finish in last place. And that's how they're going to go about it.
Yeah. What is the acceptable level of collateral damage, I guess, is the question facing all sport. Of how many people are having to work in those hotels that all the players are staying in, who I presume can't quarantine themselves then for weeks on end and have to go back home to their families. And what happens if, well, I guess we've seen this in the Bundesliga. Maybe this is one of the surprising things that I didn't think. I sort of thought once one person within a group tested positive, that it's sort of almost like with the Bundesliga where 10 players tested positive, that'd be the end of it. But actually, it seems we're going to plow on. If you test positive, you withdraw. Maybe if somehow they look at the rest of your pairing and who you've been close to, and if they're not feeling well, they all withdraw. But aside from that, it seems they're just going to plow on. But like, the big question mark is, what if something goes horribly wrong? Who's responsible?
PGA Tour, ultimately. I mean, you can argue players have informed consent, and that is true. But yeah, that's the fear. If you're an administrator now in those sports, you are just fearing that kind of news and how it will look.
But it's not the players. Like, it's not the players. The players are probably best positioned because of their wealth as much as anything else to isolate themselves from as many people as possible and come into contact with very few people. There's just an awful lot of people around who are going to have to work in this who won't have that luxury.
Mm. It was interesting on the point you make about if somebody tests positive, if a player tests positive, because at UFC 249 last weekend in Florida, one of the Brazilian fighters, Souza, was his second name, he tested positive on the eve of the fight. And there was video footage everywhere of him at the hotels, high-fiving other fighters, next fighters, you know. And he tests positive on the eve of the fight. So, as you said, it's not like everything is shut down. He just has his fight cancelled and all the other fighters are tested. And it's business as usual. That seems like the only way it's going to work, because if one test shut the whole thing down, one test, we're going to have positives. You know, I think a regular thing over the next couple of months as we return to sport will be player X has tested positive. So he's out of the weekend. He'll be back in 2 or 3 weeks' time. If it was going to be a case that it would shut down the whole thing, there'd be no point in starting. So that's where they are, June 11th.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Fionn? It's like, maybe it is the fact that all of this is still so new and we're only 9-10 weeks into it, that in 9-10 weeks' time, we'll all be a bit more accepting that we have to take some risk to go about with our general life.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, or it would seem to me that that's going to be what's happened. It's not about zero. It's about what is the level of acceptable risk and acceptable damage that anything can absorb before it calls for an immediate shutdown. Because as both of you have pointed out, if the likelihood of one test is like, must be very, very, very high, one test being positive. So surely in planning, they have absorbed all of this and are willing to say, okay, right, we have provisions in place for anyone who does test positive, but the threshold at which we're going to call the whole thing off has to be higher than an individual test or whatever it is. And that kind of, particularly in the US, when you look at what I was going to say the prevailing attitude, but it's not really the prevailing attitude, where you still have a majority in favor of lockdown restrictions, etc. But there is this massive impetus to kind of start cranking up the wheels of this economy. And, you know, in strictly sporting terms, the PGA is, this is the economy of the PGA. They have to start getting tournaments up and running, and otherwise they lose all their income. The sponsors get tons of money, don't get anything return on their investment. So all of these things matter. And to go back to the earlier point, I wonder if, I mean, of course, each individual golfer is self-employed person, so it's up to them whether they want to play or not. But I wonder whether the PGA leaned on some of the top stars and said, look, it would be brilliant if you could be part of this early start, because we need, like, as Joe, as you pointed out, it's not much fun watching an event with like the lower 40 players in the world who frankly aren't household names and maybe aren't of interest to anybody but their own immediate circle. So if you have one or two big names starting in these early tournaments, it helps kind of push that tournament into the foreground. So yeah.
The other side is, as hopefully this does resume and goes okay and we can get towards potentially some sort of major championship season, is what happens with the international players. So pictures in the paper today, Tommy Fleetwood was out at his local course yesterday. He's obviously still in England. He faces 14 days of quarantine if he goes to America. And when he decides to go back to England, faces 14 more days of quarantine. So like, do those players who aren't in America, like, do they go now? Or again, are they going to wait and see? Are they going to think, actually, it's just not worth it? I don't want to be on play.
We talked about this last week. And at the time, now, as we all know, is everything changes day to day. You know, the reality is shifting all the time. But that the PGA have calculated that of the international players that aren't fully resident in the US, it's surprisingly not a huge number of them. I can't remember the number, but it was like, you know, I think it was like 30 players or 40 players or something like that. Tommy Fleetwood being one of them. But when you have like your likes of Rory's in Florida, Ian Poulter, et cetera, et cetera. So there are still a big chunk of international players who are based in the US. And so that the effect isn't, the impact rather, isn't going to be as dramatic as perhaps we thought beforehand.
Well, let's talk to a man who's on the front line, in effect, when it comes to this story. Seamus Power joins us. We know you're stateside, Seamus. Where in the world are you?
I'm in South Carolina at the moment, staying in the old warm South Carolina.
Golf has been deemed an essential activity in that part of the world, hasn't it? You actually have been able to golf during this whole crisis.
I have. It's been so, like, I live in North Carolina most of the time. And yeah, it was one of the rules in the US are funny. Yeah, it was deemed essential. So it stayed open. Every courses and stuff made some changes. Like you know, you weren't touching the pins. They would, a lot of the courses had like styrofoam stuff in the cups. Your ball kind of stayed on top and you just pick it up and away you go. But for the most part, it was open and kind of not a problem, which was, it's great. Like other states, even down here in South Florida and California and different states over here, closed golf courses. But I was lucky in North Carolina. So I was able to stay nice and busy kind of throughout all this.
We were talking to Shane Lowry about 5-6 weeks ago, who's obviously in Florida, and he hadn't picked up a club in weeks at that stage. I know he's back out in the course now. There's part of you thinking there's a lot of golfers who want to play a lot of golf and might be a little bit rusty going back, and you're just going to be cruising on through when the PGA Tour does return?
Yeah, I'm definitely lucky that way. They were shut down for a while. It definitely could be. I got some really good practice done, but there's still enough of a gap, I think, where guys will be okay. But then I did see last night that in Los Angeles County or something, they extended the stay at home by 3 months or something. So I don't know if there's anyone stuck there. That's obviously going to be a tricky thing. But no, I've definitely been more fortunate than most guys. I've been practicing away like crazy, been staying sharp. I'll definitely be ready to go when time comes. But I'm sure like Shane, it's like another off season. 3-4 weeks to get ready is more than enough for most guys.
How has North South Carolina fared with COVID? I mean, it's interesting. It's not as shut down as other places. Has it been badly hit? Are the numbers really high, or has it come out unscathed?
I mean, relatively unscathed, I guess. I mean, still, I don't know. I think in North Carolina, the number of cases was maybe 15 to 20,000 type thing, but not too bad. I mean, like Charlotte, the city. I mean, the greater Charlotte metropolitan area has 2 or 3 million people, and North Carolina probably has more people than it does in Ireland even. So it's like not too bad, at least compared to, the US is odd like that. I mean, New Jersey, New York, you know, Chicago, Detroit, big cities are getting hammered, but some of the lesser populated places haven't been too bad. But then, you know, this whole thing, I don't think anyone seems to know. Like, it still seemed rather early to get everything up and running again. But I mean, I obviously no idea what's really going on. So I don't know. I mean, for the most part, it's been okay. I mean, I don't know if that means that, but I know one person that got it kind of in the Carolinas. So it hasn't been as widespread as other areas, but obviously still feeling the effects of it.
Yeah, it's a very strange time. We were just talking there about the return to PGA Tour action, June the 11th in Texas. Are you going? Are you playing?
I won't. It doesn't look like I'm getting in there. So it does, the first two I don't look good for. So the first one's in Texas, in Fort Worth, and the second one's in Hilton Head, South Carolina. And the numbers look a lot of guys, because neither of those two states have been hit particularly badly, I think guys are more willing. The next couple of weeks after that, I'll be interesting. It's in Connecticut in the Northeast and in Detroit, which have been two of the worst hit areas. And you can see it in the commitment numbers. I mean, I think I'm borderline for travelers, but I'm well in the field in Detroit. So that's kind of where I'm hoping. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, with my conditional status, the summer was originally going to be my busy stage, but now I'm not really sure. After such a break, guys are going to play these events that they wouldn't have necessarily played before. So I'm more than likely, my first couple events are going to be on the Korn Ferry Tour, at least the first couple. Knowing that I won't get in for PGA Tour events, and you know, it'd be nice to knock off some rust and just kind of get up and going again and get into the feel of it and into the kind of in the bit of momentum going.
Is any part of you concerned about going back out? And even though these are going to be behind closed doors events, it seems like numbers involved, still somewhere up near 1,000 people they feel in or around a golf course over the course of the week. As you say, you're in a part of the world that hasn't been massively affected, having to go play golf in a part of the world that has been seriously affected. Have you had to think long and hard about whether you go, or is this your life and you just got to do it?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that worries me, and it's not something that you kind of see brought up, is I don't think they quite know the long-term effects of this thing yet. Like, I've read some things where, like, there's possibility of, like, lungs being pretty badly damaged long-term, which would obviously would be kind of a scary thing. I mean, their tour, they gave us like a 37-page booklet, you'd call it, the other day, on the precautions they're going to take, and they're pretty extensive. But, you know, the chances are there's going to be 1,000 people, and you're going to be 1,000 people in Texas, and then moving all the way across country to South Carolina, and then up to, you know, it's inevitable that some people are going to start getting it. So it definitely is, it is some bit of a worry. But at the same time, you know, I suppose I understand the fact that at some point they're going to have to get back into it, and this worry, it doesn't seem like it's going to go away anytime soon. So I think they're aware of that. I mean, even waiting another 2 months, like, they're looking at it going, they don't really know if that's going to help at all. I mean, they're talking about a second kind of coming of it in the fall months over here in America. So I guess they're probably realize that at some point they're kind of going to have to start, and there is going to be some risk and keys to mitigate it, I guess, as best as possible.
Seamus, in this 37-page document, is there any instruction that will directly impact on the actual playing of a golf round in a pro tournament? As in, you mentioned that in practice rounds you have styrofoam in the cups, so, and you're not meant to be taking the flags out. Are they going to do, is there any changes going to happen?
Not particularly. I mean, there's going to be a bit more, it's going to be quite a bit on the caddy. So, like, the caddy when player interaction is going to be unusual, because they're, you know, they're telling us you still need to social distance. So your kind of player caddy thing is going to be a little different, and the player and the caddy is going to be responsible for cleaning the flags, cleaning the rakes, and keeping the club sanitized throughout the round. But I don't think so. Like, when I heard about all these precautions coming in, I was like, I don't know how doable this is going to be. But honestly, after reading it, they're obviously quite extensive, but there's none of them that are undoable. You know, you're kind of going to have to be pretty diligent, and like, there's a lot of different things, and the warm up beforehand, like, they're going to, I mean, things like that are going to be strange. There's going to be set stations, like, you know, 2 meters apart on the driving range, and like, things like that. And it's going to be a bit awkward or whatnot. But I do think it will be doable. So that part was kind of pleasant reading. It's just going to be take a lot of. The danger with this stuff is it doesn't take any more than a handful of people not to do things properly, and it could mess it up for everyone. Because that's, I mean, that's obviously the biggest fear. You know, the first tournament back, and, you know, everyone gets tested after Friday or Saturday round, and three of the guys in the top five or something fail a test, and all of a sudden they're pulled out of their tournament. And, you know, it kind of makes it look like it would just look a bit ridiculous almost. You know, guys start just being pulled off the leaderboard. So that's going to be the big thing. I think a lot of it's going to be on the players and caddies to do all the little things, you know, like everyone's been trying to do over the last couple of months. You know, when we're at tournaments, we're not going to be allowed to go out to bars and restaurants to eat. They're going to encourage you to get, like, room service almost exclusively. Just being, you know, being responsible and being as careful as you can. I mean, the risk is going to be there, but you can certainly reduce risks by, you know, acting smart and doing the things that they're asking us to do.
In terms of your life out there over the last while, whose family, who are you with, how are you spending your time? Are there kids on the scene? What's day-to-day life away from practicing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, away from practice, it's been quiet. I mean, so I have an apartment in Charlotte, and I live with a good buddy there. So that part of it's been pretty enjoyable. I wouldn't fancy being in a place by myself. Don't have any kids or anything like that. So it's been, you know, the evenings are quiet. But I said, I've been lucky. I mean, every day I'm busy until 5 or 6 o'clock between practice and gym stuff. So it's not too bad. I don't have, you know, getting out in the fresh air, and the weather has been beautiful here. And so being able to out and practice and kind of just get out and about, and evening time still feel a bit bizarre. You're just kind of, you know, you just realize you're kind of stuck then inside. But I said, I know that's a lot better than most people. So I kind of much to complain about, really.
That American twang of yours is getting ever more strong. Mm-hmm.
I know. I need my caddy Simon to get back over here and teach me back some Irish accent.
How long have you been out there now? I know you went to East Tennessee, wasn't it? And you turned pro in 2011, so I guess, geez, well over a decade.
Yeah, I mean, I think I flew to the US August 24th, 2006 was when I went to college originally. So it'll be just a few months time. It'll be 14 years on and off. Yes, I mean, it's amazing where the time, the time goes by so fast. It's scary. But yeah, so I've been here a long time now. But, you know, again, for what I'm doing, I still feel like I'm kind of in the best place for myself, but it definitely hurts the old accent, that's for sure.
It's funny, you know, so you're 33 now. In most other sports, you would be looking at retirement. So you,
I know.
I think golfers get a real sense of, my God, how quickly it goes.
Yeah, really do, because, I mean, in golf terms, I mean, they're like 31 to 37 or 8 are almost your prime years, really. And as you said, in most sports, 33, are like some teams looking to push you out the back door at 33, and you're like, but it's just different, you know. Like, if anything, I feel better now than I have. I mean, you just learn so much about kind of what you need for golf, and it's not the same as other sports where you need to be, you know, fittest and most explosive to play your best. You know, so much of it is about experience and about your mental strength and stuff like that, which for at least someone like me, you don't really have in your early 20s. You know, some of these kind of like phenom guys seem to have it, but it's different for everyone. And yeah, so I hopefully got several good years left of me.
Are you very much set on the PGA Tour? I know you were back in Ireland last year and you played the Irish Open down in Lahinch for the first time in quite a number of years. Like, is your life in America, or is there an appeal to coming back to Ireland and basing yourself on the European Tour for a couple of years?
Like, I mean, I'd love to do it a lot. I mean, most European guys, you'd love to play both circuits. But, you know, until I started getting some wins or started getting to the top 15 in the world, it's just not doable, really. Like, you'd end up losing both your status in both places. So hopefully, you know, if I could really get going, and, you know, when it was a case where I could get I'm not sure the minimum number of tournament requirement is in Europe anymore, but, you know, if you could get both starts and you could, you know, have exemptions over here where you'd have more freedom to go play there. Like, I'd absolutely love to do that. I mean, you'd love to play golf all over the world. So we'll see. We'll see long term. But I mean, right now, it's just for me, the last couple of years, trying to hold on to one job has been hard enough. So well, hold on to two now would be a bit of a struggle.
Yeah.
On that front, to jog people's memories, so you turned pro in 2011. You get onto the PGA Tour in 2017. That's your rookie season. 2018, I think you make the FedEx playoffs in 2018.
Yeah, 17-18 season I did, yeah.
Yeah, 2019, you managed a fifth and a sixth place finish, your best finishes in the PGA Tour, but you finished 1-2-6 in the standings. So for this year, your fourth year, you mentioned conditional status. Does that basically just mean you take every event that you can get and it's contingent on whether the Rory McIlroys of the world decide to play that week or not? Is that the gig?
Pretty much, yeah. So in my status, I'll get in all the smaller events, like the ones that you wouldn't even have heard of. Like, I'll get in the tournaments all opposite the majors, or most majors. There's like a smaller tournament opposite those ones. And then like the lesser ones, whatever. Like, there's still, I mean, that's the beauty of the PGA Tour. There's still $7.5 million purses, but it wouldn't be, big name guys wouldn't have any interest. Like, you'd have ones like the one, like John Deere, for example, is one. And, you know, there's a bunch of tournaments like that where, like, the Byron Nelson's one. It's like, they're really big tournaments and they're normal events, but they're just, the way they fall in the schedule, that the likes of, you said, Rory and those big name guys are either preparing for a major, or there's two or three big events before or after. And so I get in all those ones, but you've plenty of opportunities. I mean, on a normal year, you would get in, you know, 15 kind of minimum. If you played well, maybe 18 to 20. So you still have lots and lots of opportunities. Worst case scenario, pretty much the same.
Peter Lawrie, right now, usually guest presents on this show as well. He's not with us today, but he's spoken brilliantly at times about the stress of life on the bubble, fighting for your card, and particularly going back to Q school, and also sitting at home on a Sunday night or a Monday morning and getting a call saying you're in and having to fly halfway around the world. And obviously the expense that comes with that, and then trying to justify that expense, even though you're part of practice and everybody else, and somehow perform at your best on a Thursday when all the odds stacked against you. When you were playing in normal times for the first few events of the year, how did you cope with that stress and the not knowing?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously stressful, but it's a funny, like, you'd prefer to be in normally and make your schedule. But for me, that's just not realistic. Like, at least this season, you know, if I play better, it becomes a realistic thing. But as I said, I've had the last couple of years where, like, I had full status last year and I did my least amount of points that I did in my 3 years on tour. So it's much more about quality rather than quantity. And it's kind of just to keep that in mind. But it's also easier in the PGA Tour because, I mean, European Tour is tough. I mean, as you said, Peter could get a call and he has to go to, who knows, like anywhere around the world. I mean, the European tour is tough going like that. We're in the US. Like, I'm in Charlotte. I mean, there's no place in the country that I can't get on a flight and go nonstop and be there in 4 hours, you know. So it makes a big difference on that end too. But it's not the ideal situation, but I think you just have to get in your mind that that's the way it's going to be until you kind of play your way into full status, or you get a win or something like that, and then you can kind of pick and choose and do what you want to do.
You mentioned last year was your toughest year at the lowest number of points. Give us the story of last year. What happened? Did you lose your game, or just a bit unlucky, or what? Where were you?
Yeah, no, I just struggled. I mean, you'd love to say a bit unlucky, but no, I just struggled. It was a funny season. I was at a horrible start, like all the way through the West Coast, which is, I mean, probably 12 tournaments in. I played very, very poorly. And then I played kind of decently. The players got me going. And then I had that very good run where I finished like 6th, 5th, and 13th, I think, 3 weeks in a row, which I got the majority of my points for the year. And then the rest of the summer was okay. Like, I made lots of cuts. Like, I made my last, or 7 of my last 8 cuts, or 6 of the last. But I was just finishing, you know, 40th and 45th. And you just don't get enough points doing that. It's just, it's the points are top heavy. And that's, you just, you know, one top 10 finish is better than 8 events finishing like 40th, you know. So it was a weird season. I had that one little purple patch. And I did have opportunities in those events to really make some extra points, but I didn't play very well, to be honest. I don't really have any grand excuse other than that. I was just struggled, dug myself a massive hole, then dug myself out of it, and wasn't able to keep it going after that. So yeah, that's how I ended up in a conditional ball.
Seamus, can I ask you, changed coach, was it a year ago you changed coach?
I've changed a couple of times, actually. So I worked with Justin Parsons starting last February in Riviera. Yeah. I met Justin. I worked with Justin until like this January. And then I switched back to a coach I used when I played my best golf on the mini tour in my first kind of year on the first couple of years on the web, wasaweb.com at the time. So I'm just based in Charlotte. I think that seems to suit me a little better when I have a little bit more access to them and it's kind of close by, where I can just, you know, if I'm struggling a little bit, I can just kind of go over there and have a look for 20 minutes and then kind of head away again. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you know, I always say to people, like, you know, you never want to change coaches, but if you don't feel like it's not working, it's tough when to know when to pull the trigger or pull the plug, because you don't want to go too soon if you think it's on the right track. But you also, again, in my boat, like, when you're really trying to hold on to your job, you don't want to wait too long. And then, you know, if you wait a bit too long, you really can play your way out of any kind of status. So it's a tricky thing. But no, I said it's been going very well at the moment, so I'm kind of excited now to get back into it.
Can I read you a quote from, well, your now ex-coach, Justin Parsons, who he said, it was a relief to him to discover that some of the puzzling bad shots he was hitting were beyond his control because of his posture, and he's starting to produce some great results. Now, I know you're 6'3", but you're an experienced golfer. Talk to us about what was it with your posture?
Yeah, there was a couple of physical limitations that I actually kind of found out, which I was unaware of. I had kind of like a, I don't know what you'd call it, like basically a pretty big tightness, whatever you call it, on the left side of my neck and through my left shoulder, which I had. It was only doing certain movements, but it was in particular in the golf swing, keeping your left. It basically was, I was losing the ability to keep my left arm fully extended properly. I would kind of like slide my head this like away with my left arm because I just didn't have the extension with the left arm. And then it was weakness in an area in my right hip where, again, it was kind of hurting towards the top of my backswing. But it was interesting. Yeah, it was just through some testing. I tried to work on a couple of moves I just couldn't seem to make any headway with. And then, you know, once I identified the physical stuff and did some work on it, they almost started falling into place without actually doing any work on the swing side of it. So it was quite a relief, actually. But yeah, I mean, yeah, Justin's brilliant, and he's access to all the coolest equipment you can imagine. So it's amazing what they can kind of tell you nowadays.
So how's the game at the moment?
Very good, actually. It's actually been quite nice. I mean, like the PGA Tour schedule now, you don't really get much of an off season anymore. It goes, I got my card at the end of 16, and I almost haven't had a break since. So in one sense, at the moment, it could be a very, very good thing for me, because a couple of things that I wanted to improve and wanted to spend time working on, but you just don't have it anymore. I mean, if anyone knows, I mean, the schedule runs all the way through end of November and then you're starting first week of January. So by the time you, you know, take a week or two off just to unwind and then I'll go home for a little bit, you're back and it's a week later, you're off to Hawaii again. So you just don't have a chance to do anything. And then, you know, you're going hell for leather all the way to the end of November again. So it's been going very well. Made a couple of little changes. And I've been hitting it very, very nicely in practice and whatnot. Like probably nicest it probably it's ever been actually. So I'm really looking forward to it. You know, because it's brilliant to see it in practice and playing, like just playing practice rounds. But obviously, the true test doesn't. You know, you don't really know the full extent of it until you get back into tournament mode and hitting some shots under pressure.
When you look at the players, sorry, Finn. When you look at the players who were 50th and 60th, say in the FedEx Cup rankings, and are comfortably enough holding on to their cards, and where their game is, and where your game is, like, are there things you can identify that they're doing that you need to try and replicate that would help you get to that level?
Yeah, I mean, you've got stats for stats absolutely for everything nowadays. It's funny, like
it always seems when you look at the stats, it's very minute between say 50th and 126th.
Yeah, it really is. And that's, but you have to, I mean, so I've been losing. The disappointing one for me has been my driving. You know, I'm long, but I still, like the strokes gain thing, I've negative stroke for the last couple of years, which is for someone in the longer part, that's actually very, not hard to do, but it's very disappointing. You should be gaining. I mean, everything we know about the distance thing. So like, the driving is a big thing. And my approach play hasn't been good enough. My short game and putting has been plenty good enough to be, you know, competing and being in the top 50, 60 and tour no problem. So that, I mean, that's been the biggest area that I need to improve. And that's been the kind of one I've focused on here over the last 6-8 weeks.
Because I was looking at your stats, you're averaging this season where you've had 7 events and 4 made cuts, 3 missed cuts. You're averaging 299.5 yards. That's cruel, isn't it? They couldn't have just rounded that up.
You rounded up.
So let's do that for you. You're averaging 300 yards off the tee. And I thought that is long. That is long. But actually, that just puts you 87th on tour. That is the standard we're talking about. But your percentage of fairways hit is right down.
It is poor. Yeah, yeah. And that's where, I mean, that's where the strokes. Like, if you like, you're hitting it. Yeah, it just hasn't been good enough. And I've been losing. I said strokes versus. I mean, just like you see. I know it's obviously Rory's probably the best driver of the ball in the world. But Rory starts a given tournament 8 strokes ahead of the field on driving alone, which is absolutely remarkable. But that's, I mean, that's obviously the standard you're looking for. But someone who does it, even someone who's hitting at 300 yards, you should be in the plus in strokes gained. But obviously the accuracy hasn't been there and it's really been hurting. And then it just all feeds from there because, you know, it's hard to get the ball as close to the hole when you're in the rough. It's harder to make birdies when you're further away from the hole. It's just simple kind of.
Yeah,
it's just a knock-on effect that makes a massive difference.
It's very interesting because of late, the way it's been talked about on tour, it's that almost distance is everything. Players don't really care if they're not on the fairway, as in the crowds are standing on the rough half the time anyway. So just bomb it and then gouge it onto the green. And that's talked about as almost the way to play modern golf. So it's actually quite interesting to hear you say that not being on the fairways does hurt.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, I often say, like, there's varying degrees of missing a fairway. Like, there's, you know, 4 yards into the rough and you still have a clear shot, and there's 15 yards into the rough when you're under trees and pitching heavy low shots. So there is varying degrees, but that is definitely a thing. But the tough part is, like, if there's so many guys bombing it that on any given week there's going to be 50, 60 of them, they're going to be hitting it pretty well and hitting a large percentage of fairways. Like, the guys that won't, you can certainly get it around nowadays. But when you get on certain golf courses, you really have to be, again, if you're hitting a 320 and you're 4 yards into the rough, it makes a big difference too versus 300 in the rough. With all the, every 10 yards, it's funny all the stats, I mean, the stats are, every 10 yards is about 0.6 of a shot. So like, the guys are really bombing it like 320. If I'm in the rough and they're in the rough, over the course of a round, they're going to beat me by 1.2 shots. So it's all related. Like, that's why, you know, I'm working on getting the speed up a little bit and obviously improving the swing and just, again, hitting it maybe one more fairway around. But the biggest one is the one or two that are going more into trees and more into more kind of serious trouble where you're kind of pitching out and it's costing you full strokes. They're the ones that really hurt.
Are they easier, and by easier, air quotes here, easier fixes than, say, if your putting stats were worryingly low? in that you can get on and you can fix whatever mechanics that you need to fix to make sure you make that extra fairway per round. And also you're talking about your approaches. He famously worked on his wedges inside 120 yards a few years ago. But whereas your putting seems really, really solid. So you must go into this feeling fairly confident that you could have a good time.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, there's obviously, you know, there's degrees to everything, but I absolutely think you can, it's easier to improve stuff like that, because there is, you know, putting is a funny thing where it's like, there's a lot, like you have to be able to read greens and you have to be able to hit putts at the right speed. It doesn't matter how much you work on your stroke, if you can't read the green properly or you can't hit it at the right speed, you just don't have a chance. Where the driver, for the most part, is just one swing that you're just standing up and you're giving it a rip. So there is definitely is an area, I think. And I've also driven it extremely well at times, so I know it's there. It's just trying to get on a more consistent basis.
Mm. It's amazing, you know, the way you reeled off those stats. They are very much to hand in your head. Mm. Is it a good thing to be on the golf course knowing all these things?
It's a more efficient way to practice with the stats we have now. Like, I mean, the funny one is the putting stuff. Like, you know, when I was younger, I would spend tons of time hitting 3-4 foot putts. But like, when you get on tour, you cannot make up any ground making 3- and 4-foot putts. You just cannot. Everyone makes them. It's just, there's no, like, even like a good putter is not missing any, and a bad putter might miss one every 10 tournaments. They're just not missed on tour. If you're missing those, you're in so much trouble. So you realize where the areas that you can make up ground, especially like to suit your game. So that's the interesting thing with the stats. Obviously on the golf course, you're never thinking that. You've different stats for the golf course like given that week, but no, the general stuff is obviously, it's much more practice orientated to, like, you know, you can look at it after a 10 tournament stretch and realize that, you know, 100 to 125 yards is by far your biggest weakness, and you're giving up half a stroke around to whenever so and that thing. So that's, it's more used for practice and kind of making practice more efficient.
Are you a scoreboard watcher?
For the most part, no. I mean, I've often said, like, if I get late on a Sunday, it only matters on certain golf courses. If I've got a, like, Torrey Pines, like, is a perfect example. If I'm standing an 18 fairway Torrey Pines, it's definitely worth knowing where you stand in relation to the lead. But a lot of holes, it just doesn't matter. You know, if it's most holes, there's really only one way to play them. You know, reachable par fives or whatnot might be a little bit of a different situation. So I look at it, but only when like points are that I think it might actually benefit me.
I don't know how relevant this is in any way at all, but that scoring will be higher when golf returns, when there's no supporters, when you're going back to your difference between 5 yards and 15 yards, that particularly for those marquee groups, there isn't somebody to suddenly, the ball magically reappears. And also, you'd wonder, is the adrenaline level going to be there, say, on a Sunday down the stretch of a tournament when there's some polite applause potentially if you hit
from the cameraman?
Shot. Yeah.
I think it'll be interesting. Like, for someone like me, I don't think it's going to make a massive difference. You know, I'm like, you know, most tournaments, if I'm not up near the lead, I only have a handful of people anyway. But I think for the likes of Rory or Tiger, or these guys, it's going to be a bizarre experience. I mean, I remember playing golf with Rory in the south of Ireland or the Close, and he would have 1,000 people following him. Like, he probably hasn't played a competitive round of golf without a lot of people following him in, I don't know, like 15 years. So I think it'll be different for someone like him. And I mean, Tiger over the years looks like he feeds off crowds like no one else. I mean, I think it will be a part of it. And you see those bigger name guys, you hit it and they hit it, and somehow their ball seems to become to more favorable positions because it hits someone and stops or does kind of things like that. So we'll see. I don't know. I think it, for the first tournaments, you know, it could be a little strange, but I think guys will adapt pretty quickly. Barring those top couple of guys, I think most guys would be more used to it than you would think.
Seamus, you mentioned Rory there in the south of Ireland. Tell us about the McIlroy you saw at that age.
Yeah, I mean, I used to describe, I remember I had this conversation with my dad. I would play with Rory, and I often thought my own game, I played with him at the south one, or sorry, the Close at European Club. I'm not sure what year it was, but it was myself, I think it was Darren Crowe and Rory. And the first round, like, European Club was playing so difficult. The cut ended up being, like over 160. It was something crazy. And the first round, he was 4 or 5 under after about 13 holes. And I remember thinking, like, he's just playing a completely different game to the rest of us. And I always, like, the way I could describe it, to like, how I would describe him was, like, if I played my best, I thought always thought I could beat everyone except him. If he played his best, there wasn't a way that I was going to be able to beat him. If I played my best and he was a little off, I could beat him. But besides that, it was just, he played with such confidence, even at a young age. And it was just, he just could hit shots that I certainly wasn't at that age, wasn't able to hit. And I hadn't seen anyone else that was able to hit at that time. So it was pretty amazing to watch. I'll always remember that European club. It was I don't even remember what he shot in the end, but he was putting on an exhibition there for a while. I couldn't believe that, like, he'd be hitting driver down holes that I'm kind of standing there hitting 2-iron because it gets too narrow, and he's just standing up hitting driver down a 10-yard gap. It was just something, it didn't even seem to make sense, but you knew it was kind of special to watch.
The Irish on the European tour have always been very close, and I know it's a very different setup in America because I think just in terms of how you go about your business and where you're based and things like that, is there a closeness amongst the Irish? Because obviously yourself, Shane, Rory are all quite similar in age and would know each other from that domestic circuit when you were back in Ireland as kids.
Yeah, I mean, like I'd be closer to Shane more when he plays. Rory is, I mean, when I see him and stuff on the putting green and stuff, like, he's still great and he'll still talk to you or whatever, but he's so big that it's hard for him to do normal stuff anymore. He's just such a big name. He's not like you kind of see him out and he's eating here or he's walking around here or doing anything like that. He's just such a big name that he really can't do the kind of things, I guess, more normal people can do. I'm sure, to be honest, Shane, after winning the Open last summer, is probably getting a little bit more like that too. But I'd probably be a little bit closer to Shane. I always look forward to when Shane or Padraig or even Rory are playing. I mean, it's just, you know, I've been in the States a while, but you still can't beat meeting someone from Ireland and just kind of talking about old times and stuff like that. It always makes you feel a bit more at home.
Of the non-Irish players, is there any guys that you're particularly close with?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's some great guys. I mean, so Joel Damon is a guy I've known. We kind of got on the web.com tour at the same time, and he's had a great run of form over the last kind of whatever. And then, like, David Hearn, I'm good buddies with. I played at Zurich, the team championship with him. Got to kind of become pretty good buddies with Dave. And then some of the other guys that came up on the web with, like, a guy called Trey Mullinax, and there's a few other guys like that. The web.com tour was kind of a fun tour to play. It was much more camaraderie. Everyone was kind of in the same boat. So you kind of develop stronger bonds with some of those guys than I have, at least with too many guys on the PGA Tour as of yet.
I was going to say, maybe the solution to the Ryder Cup dilemma for the US is to have pick 12 players from their web.com tour and have them play the European Tour guys.
Yeah.
And then it might be a little more balanced.
Yeah, it is. There's a different vibe that way for sure. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience playing the European Tour, but even just playing the Irish Open last year, it's just a different vibe. A lot of guys, at least the bigger name guys, the European or the PGA Tour, kind of travel with their, whatever you want to call it, like entourage. They all have, you don't really see them by themselves, and they're not kind of being themselves. But at the Irish Open last year, I mean, everyone was, like, even in the players' lounge, there's much more laughing and joking and kind of hanging out going on. So there's definitely a different feel. But I'm sure that is a part of the Ryder Cup. I mean, you can just see it even when guys are playing on the golf course and they're not playing in the team, the European guys look like they're getting on a little bit better. And like some of the US guys are so, I think it's just a different kind of approach. They're much more driven to individual stuff, and they can't put it aside for the team things as well as some of the European guys.
So what's the protocol? It's funny you brought this up. I wanted to ask you about this anyway, because we do hear that the US tour is that lonelier place, the entourages, the travels, the private travel. If you walk into a locker room and Phil's there and Tiger's there and there's a few other top 10 guys, is it fine for you to go up and say, hey, Phil, hey, Tiger, what's going on? How'd you play today? Is it like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, all those guys will talk away to you for sure. To me, they're all chatty. To me, a lot of the conversations just seem to stay kind of at that, like, that top level. There's no real depth to a lot of the conversations. There's not the same. At least, I mean, obviously, like, maybe to me, like, I'm an Irish person, so they probably view me as an outsider. I don't even know, but that's kind of the difference. And I think that's just like, it's, you know, we grow up, we play a lot of team golf. Like, I mean, when I grew up, like one of your big goals is to make the Munster team and to make the Irish team and stuff like that. And that's not the same deal. You know, even making Walker Cup, it's a huge deal at home. And you would ask some guys over there and they're like, they don't even know when it's on. Like that sort of, like, it's just not the same. It's not the same. You don't have the same drive to make these teams growing up. And I do think that's part of it. Like, you know, I remember playing like team golf, even in like European boys and home internationals. And I mean, the team is, it's like the team is so tight and it's everyone's rooting for each other. And I don't think they have that to the same extent, even in like, even in college golf, it's a little different because there is also an individual leaderboard and like one of the scores is getting thrown out. It's just, it's not quite as team oriented as is saying a home internationals where every single point is absolutely massive. And there is no, you know, nobody cares if you won your match, if the team lost. There's none of that versus, you know, in college, like, well, I finished fourth, even though the team finished, like, you know, last. It doesn't really. So it's just a little different, I think.
Mm. And aside from Rory, who's the best that you've played with out there over the last 4 years?
I played with Brooks the week before he won his first US Open, and it was very impressive. It was just. It's hard to describe, but it's just a different sound off his ball. And then the mental side of his game was the part that was shocking. Like he just seemed like he was so laid back. I mean, not that we were going to win the tournament, but we were like third or fourth last group on Saturday and Sunday, like, or maybe six or seven last group. Like, we were in decent shape, and he looked like he was, you know, out playing with his buddies and didn't care about his thing in the world. And as well as hitting it very, very, very solidly. So I thought that was very impressive. And I said it to him at the time, and obviously kind of, you know, hindsight, obviously it seems so smart. But at the time I was thinking, going, like, if he's ever in contention in a big tournament, he's going to be very hard to beat because he's, I don't know deep down, but certainly on the surface, he looks like he's going to care less than the other person. Those people are extremely hard to beat under pressure.
Is he a chatter on the court, like during a round?
Yeah. I mean, when I was playing with me, I mean, I guess he wouldn't be initiating too much, but he would talk away. He's a very nice guy, very nice guy. And then with Ricky on a bag, I mean, it's. I've played with those guys a couple of times, and it's great fun.
You mentioned there Torrey Pines, which kind of reminded me that you're living the absolute dream. You know, we're talking about this. What are the two or three best courses on the PGA Tour?
TPC Sawgrass is an iconic finish, but a whole course is great. Like, it's... whole shaping each way is long hitter. Everyone's got a chance, long hitter, short hitter. I think that's a fantastic test. You have to shape it both ways, and everyone's got a chance. I think the course we play in Tampa, it's called Innisbrook. The Copperhead at Innisbrook is amazing. And Torrey Pines South course to me is unbelievable. The setting and the history and just the whole thing there is just incredible.
God, it's amazing to be playing these courses because you must have grown up a golf nut. You must arrive at Torrey Pines and still think. Or even you played Pebble Beach earlier this year.
I played Pebble.
So you must be thinking, I know what Nicholas hit here in the US Open. I know what Tiger did here. That's one of the great things about golf, that you have that back catalogue every time you rock up the course.
Yeah, Pebble's amazing. You do the 2000 US Open or whatever is extremely iconic in I mean, I remember watching it. I was later getting into golf, but I do remember like all the talk about that. It was just incredible.
When you say late getting into golf, how late?
The first time I played golf was like 11 or 12. But then I didn't really, the difference with me, like it wasn't in my family or anything like that. So I wouldn't have paid much attention to it. I do remember like the significance of Tiger winning in 97, the Masters. Like, I didn't really know what was going on, but I'm, you know, you as I described, you could hear it in like the commentators and other players' voices of that this just was something special about this. So I always remember that. And then I was 14 or 15 before I kind of really started getting into it and started understanding it all. So it was a little bit later, but yeah.
How old are you when you shot your first subpar round?
Oh, I don't have a clue. I would say 15 or 16. I would say 15 maybe.
Wow. There's no hope for the rest of us.
So probably within a year or two, we're taking it seriously.
Yeah, I got good pretty quickly. Like, I was lucky. I got on, like, in early Irish panels. like an under 15 panel on Ireland, and the Munster kind of thing. We're doing the same thing. So I was introduced to people who were kind of helping me along with coaching and that sort of thing. So it was that helped me a lot.
Right. And did someone coach you to get good enough to do that, or did you just go out and play around yourself?
No, I mean, like I started, my first, David Hayes is a PGA pro in Dungarvan Golf Club, and he had group lessons at a driving range. I remember going there, and then I remember I went to first person who got like proper lesson was like Don McFarlane in East Cork Golf Club, and then when I got into the Munster thing, like I got a lot of lessons for years from Fred Toomey. But yeah, that was kind of, yeah.
So just got good quick. So like first couple of times you hit a driver, you were thinking, yeah, I got the hang of this.
The first time I played, I remember I was able to hit it okay. Like I played a lot of hurling. So I had the hurling for a long time. Well, I don't know how long, but for a little while. And so I was able to hit it okay. And my brothers and I kind of started playing around the same time. And we all played hurling. So we could all hit it a bit, but obviously the rest of it wasn't very pretty.
Yeah. We hate you.
It's true.
We're slaving. Listen, thanks so much for doing this. It's been great to catch up. We'll see you pretty soon. So you reckon maybe third, fourth week back when the big names are putting their feet up, you'll probably be out there and trying to get things going again?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. I'm going to play the Corn Ferry the first couple of weeks and then kind of wait and see. There's so many unknowns. I think there's so much. Let's see. I think a lot of guys are maybe going to watch from the sideline for a couple of weeks and see how it all goes and then kind of decide. But yeah, hopefully the third or fourth week, we're going to get going and get cracking again.
We wish you well. Let's check back in at the end of the season. Seamus Power, thanks so much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Cheers, Seamus.
Thanks, Seamus.
See you, lads. Bye. There we are, Seamus Power. So that's nice to actually chat up with him properly. Nathan, I'm sure you've had the same experience I've had on Off the Ball, whereby the cell coverage in the States is dreadful. So anytime you do speak to him, it's 10 minutes and
yes.
Not a great chat. It's actually great to do that and look forward to watching him now, hopefully go well over the next few weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Hope he gets the chances, and he probably will, because as he's saying, a lot of players are going to probably skip more tournaments than he ordinarily would. And that when he does get his game, that he takes it, because he is a player who generally has good rounds in tournaments. It's just probably that little bit of consistency that all those players that are on the bubble seem to struggle with. It's incredible how every player we talk to talks about Rory, just been so much ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, I know, hitting shots I couldn't even think of hitting. I wish I'd been at one of those West of Ireland's or South of Ireland's, 1,000 people following him. I've never gone to watch one of those. Even when we were in Lahinch last summer, I was thinking it'd be a lovely thing to come down and do. I watch a South of Ireland or a West of Ireland. Must do it sometime.
I was at a West of Ireland in Ross's Point one year?
Ross's Point, yeah.
When I was working in Galway, there was somebody from Galway was in contention. I remember getting sent up to it. It's a very nice, chilled out, if the weather's nice scenario. If the weather's nice, well, like watching golf anywhere. Yeah. If the weather's nice, it's a beautiful thing. Rory has a big test ahead of him this weekend. How is he going to make entertaining conversation? Considering Phil and Tiger couldn't conjure up anything of interest for the match. Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no. That's
not Spieth. Spieth and Rory would be.
Yeah. Apparently, Rory and DJ hang out all the time. Mm. I wouldn't have paired them together as natural bedfellows, but apparently they do. Yeah, over the last couple of years, they have started hanging out, living in the same area. So
these events are weird. But you're looking at the setup for a Sunday night, so it's obviously a sort of skins game as well.
Is skins a thing over here? Do people play? I have never, with anyone in the last however long, 10 years, found someone turn around and say, "Will we play skins?" It just doesn't seem to be a thing anymore, if it ever was here.
No, because you might even find yourself playing for a euro a hole or something, and then 8 holes in, you've totally forgotten about how it's all going.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's true. It's, I've played skins with friends, but only friends who picked it up from playing it in the US.
Right.
It is the classic friends game in America, is skins.
Is it?
Yeah.
So in short, and I don't know all the rules, you play each hole, and if you draw the hole, the amount goes on.
It carries over. It rolls over. So it's €2. If you're playing €1 hole, it's €2 on the... It depends if... Yeah, so you just keep rolling over. So, I mean, it's kind of a weirdly unfair game where you could keep having holes, or you could win, say, four holes and then skins rolled over. All you do is win the one hole worth all the money, and you win all the money. And it's like, it's not a particularly, I wonder if it's not that common in our part of the world, because it's not really an accurate reflection of how well you played. It's just more like you shone when the money was high.
Yeah.
Cause you could lose the first four holes.
Yeah.
And then the next four are tied, and then you win the ninth hole and you've suddenly got more money than the other guy, despite beating him on one hole.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
What they're doing with Rory is, I think it's something like 50 grand per hole. And then the 17th hole is going to be worth 200 grand. And the 18th hole is worth $500,000. Now, part of this and part of all these charity events, there's very much like a home game side of this. One is playing for one nurse's charity.
I know.
And the other one is playing for another charity.
I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think a charity wants to be on tenterhooks watching this match. Yeah. I think let's just pick one charity.
It's a bit like the chase. It's like the celebrity chase. Like, what charity are you raising money for? And it's like, oh. And as we've said before, it's just like making sure that this money is going to charity rather than, you know, the player's pocket is an important part of it. But I mean, I don't know. When I sit down to watch it, I couldn't care less about the money, frankly. It means
no, I think the fact Rory is involved makes it more interesting. I'd be interested to see, considering the Tiger Phil experience we've had, how dire and dull.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
Yeah. Is Rory's force of personality strong enough that he can carry this off by himself? Like, Matthew Wolf is doing very well to get in there.
Very well, Matthew. You've done incredibly well here.
I suppose
at least they haven't tried to build this as, here's the smack talk all week and the build up to it. Like, Phil and Tiger set unrealistic expectations. They're doing the smack talk stuff again.
Is there a fourth player, or is it just the three of them?
Ricky Fowler.
Ricky Fowler, yeah.
It's Dustin Johnson and Rory against Ricky Fowler and Matthew Wolf.
Oh, okay. Look,
we'll watch it.
Did you see Tiger and Phil's banter last week where Phil shows the picture of Tiger putting on the green jacket and then Tiger puts the green jacket over. I'm like, who's winning? Is this not a draw here?
Oh, yeah, you both have
won. You got a green jacket. It's like,
yeah. Well, of course we'll watch it, because the other choice is the South Korean League. That's it.
Now, the Bundesliga is back. The Bundesliga is back.
Oh, is the Bundesliga back this weekend?
Yeah.
Are you going to watch Bundesliga? Like, are we going to do pieces on a Monday night on the Bundesliga?
I don't know. I'll probably watch something this weekend.
I'll watch it out of curiosity.
It'll be a novelty. I'll watch it out of what's it like watching it behind closed doors. Because I've commentated on games behind closed doors, and that's not a fun experience.
Yeah, it's tough for the commentators. I saw talk that the broadcasters will give you the option on the red button to have fake commentary played through, but it won't have much correlation to what's happening on the pitch, is the only thing.
Well, you hear everything. You and Aaron was mentioning this the last night. They did a game last season in the Europa League. I think it was PSV Eindhoven were playing against Marseille, and Jetro Willems, now plays for Newcastle, defender, got sent off right in front of the two dugouts on the halfway line. And all the microphones are obviously there.
Yeah.
Call the referee. He has very good English, it turns out. He's got all the words.
All the Anglo-Saxon words.
He has all the words, including the C word.
No.
Right. Called the referee this, as he was being sent off. And you're like, ooh.
Should I apologize?
Apologies for
that. He's quoting language.
It's throwing up lots of funny things. At UFC 249, we did a piece during the week with Kevin Ioli. And two different fighters credited Daniel Cormier, who was on co-commentary, with turning the fight in their favor, as in they could hear everything. So Cormier was saying things like, oh, he needs to change what he's doing there when he's leading with the left or whatever. And
right.
The fighters heard this and thought, that's a really good point. Changed their approach and then credited Cormier on commentary afterwards with helping them win the fight. So interesting times. There was one last thing I was going to say. Can't remember. Oh, yeah. Sorry. It is terribly grim, though, that some of these golf tournaments and who plays in them is determined by how badly hit that respective state is. Mm. You know, there's just something very surreal about that, you know. So even Seamus Power there turning around to his family and saying, well, I'm going to play in Connecticut because that's...
Nobody else wants to play there.
Else wants to play there, this is it.
All right. Listen, fellas, great stuff. Let's chat next week.
Cheers, lads.
The OTB Podcast Network.